Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and how the tech are you? It's time for a classic episode of Tech Stuff. This episode originally published on May 4th, 2015, so hey, Star Wars Day. It is titled The Story of Internet Explorer Part 1, which I guess means you can probably have a pretty good idea of what next week's classic episode is going to be. This episode featured special guest Nate Langson. Nate is awesome, great tech journalist. I should have him on the show again. It's been too long since I last spoke with him. Hope you enjoy.
Nate is joining me to talk about Internet Explorer. And the reason why we're talking about it is that it's a web browser that has a very long history. And that history now seems to have an end cap to it because Microsoft appears to be leaving Internet Explorer behind and embracing a new product that currently is codenamed Project Spartan, but will probably have some different name once it actually goes live. So we're going to cover the dramatic history that's filled with tons of interesting stories, as it turns out. And to really get started, we have to turn the clock back before there was ever any web browsers at all. At the birth of the first web browser, which we can trace back to Christmas Day, December 25th, 1990.
Wow, 1990. MCMXC, as the Romans would have called it.
Right. I'm glad you took that. Whenever I start thinking about Roman numerals, I have to start dialing IXII, which only makes sense for the listeners here in America. Tim Berners-Lee was working at CERN, same people who are responsible for the Large Hadron Collider, and had developed a program that would allow for the retrieval and display of information in a way that would make sense, make it easy to navigate. This would become the first web browser, which is kind of funny because without the web browser, you really don't have a World Wide Web. You definitely had an internet because the internet is a network of networks. And a lot of people, I realize, maybe this isn't as bad as it used to be, but a lot of people often will say web and mean internet or vice versa. They'll use the terms interchangeably. Not entirely correct.
I've described it in the past, actually, to people who get this wrong as the web is the car on the highway that is the internet.
Right.
They are, the web sits on top of the net.
Right. And there are other vehicles on that same highway, right? Because email does not have to be web-based. FTP, file transfer protocol, other protocols. In fact, the way I originally really made use of the internet back in the day was through the Telnet chat client. I used that a lot when I was in college as a way of distracting myself and making friends with people who were more into the same things I was into. I went to, for the first 2 years of my schooling, a small community college in rural Georgia, and a lot of the people I was around didn't share the same interests I did. So Telnet was one of those things that allowed me to go beyond that. But that was before I had ever heard of the World Wide Web and web browsers. So we have to remember that this time before there were browsers, there were not really any user-friendly ways of accessing information. You kind of had to really dive into the tech and understand commands in order to get anything out of it. Even if those commands were fairly simple, it was a high enough barrier of entry that there were only a few of us playing in that world at that time, right? I mean, there were like people in colleges and research facilities and governments that had access to it for various official purposes. There were very few like fun applications outside of some wacky people saying, hey, this computer that's crunching numbers for your astronomy class, we can also make it play tic-tac-toe.
Yeah. I mean, around about this time, there were also other similar sort of projects, I think, that were going on at CERN. Like people built sort of not competing necessarily, but there were other programs that were created to sort of browse in a more visual way.
Right. And it turns out that this was a brilliant idea. Another little thing to fall back on is just a quick explanation of what's going on with a web browser. For those of you who are, more casual fans of technology, this might be helpful. For those of you who, are really deep in the field, this is going to sound incredibly simplistic, but we have to talk about what a client is and what a server is. So your client is essentially your machine, the device you're using to end up retrieving information from some other computer, a server, which actually holds the information that you are interested in. So if you are using a web browser to visit a web page, there is somewhere in the world a computer that has all that information on it, and it gets the request from your browser, the client, and says, all right, well, here's what you asked for, and sends it across the internet. Your browser is in charge of displaying that information in some way that hopefully is useful and informative. And that's the basic relationship that the web browser is built around. It's not the only client-server relationship, but it's a great example of one.
Mm. And it's interesting because, as I'm sure we will be coming to later, the relationship between the idea of a client-server model really has not changed. And in fact, when you get into the likes of the Chrome OS, the browser is just a dumb client. It's a client terminal model for the entire OS, and essentially. But we're moving forward 25 years before we get to that point.
The nice thing is that this model works so well that it ended up being the foundation for a lot of different applications, including the Chrome operating system. And of course, we're seeing more and more services and applications migrating to the internet side of things, where we see this, it's kind of a seesaw act, right? On one side, we see hardware manufacturers that are still saying, no, you really want the strongest, fastest machine possible. And meanwhile, all the service providers are saying, we're handling all the heavy lifting. You just need a device that can connect to us. That way we get to control all the stuff. But it's because of this relationship that that kind of infrastructure is even possible.
Mm. That's the interesting thing also, just as a slight related tangent, I suppose, about Moore's Law, which is celebrating an anniversary at the moment, is that it's always been assumed that we need the most and biggest and fastest power in our computers because we want to do more and more things locally, which in a way, if that was always going to be true, you would need less and less on the server side, outside of the realms of the web. But of course, now it's becoming much more about efficiency and low cost and thinness in our devices. And so we don't need that sort of huge lifting power within the machines we're currently using ourselves, which makes a browser the perfect interface for a modern machine, because it just needs to be the go-between, the conduit between the very powerful server and the very small, powerful, less powerful desktop machine or laptop or tablet or notebook or what have you. And it means Moore's Law may actually become irrelevant before it actually becomes wrong. You know, we may not need that power, that sort of doubling of power every 18 months, because we have actually no need for that power anymore.
And in fact, Moore's Law originally was all about the financial side of, you know, the fact that there were these financial drivers that were incentives to create these increasingly more powerful and smaller components on a square inch of silicon. Now we're getting to a point where if we don't need that, then there's less incentive. So there may be a point of pride among some, you know, engineers and computer scientists who want to keep pushing that envelope and try and make it, try and beat their record in a way. But if the demand isn't there, then, like you said, Moore's Law could become obsolete before we hit that fundamental limit from the laws of physics that
And if a motor car had gone through the same exponential growth that Moore's Law predicted for silicon, you would be able to do 100 miles on 1/10 of a milliliter of fuel, and that would cost you 25 cents.
Right.
In a car that costs 25 cents.
Right. And in order to get back to the world that where this is being, you know, this is a relevant thing, going back to the early 90s, these are the days where early 90s, I was in high school about to go into college, and early to mid 90s, that's my high school college years. In those early 90s, you started seeing lots of different programmers build their own web browsers. A lot of them were within CERN. Some of them were in colleges and universities. And we started to see more people get access to it because it was very clear that this was going to be a useful tool to navigate information. We move on to February 1993, and that's when Mark Andreessen and Eric Bina of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, a.k.a. the NCSA, our mutual friend Tom Merritt, I believe, went to the University of Illinois. NCSA, they decided to introduce a browser themselves. It was the Mosaic browser. It was on Unix. It was also for the ex-Windows platform. Their colleague, Alex Todick, created a version that could run on Macintosh computers. So this was a browser that could run on cross-platforms, although the appearance of web information varied depending upon what platform you were using. So it wasn't a smooth experience across all platforms. It wasn't something that was, it wasn't like you were going to get the exact same experience on one machine as on another, but you could get to the information. And it had a lot of features that set apart from the earlier web browsers, like things that we take for granted now, like bookmarks. You know, that would, being able to mark a specific web page as something of interest so that you can easily navigate to it in the future was really important. Also, things like icons and pictures as opposed to just text, which made it more attractive to look at. And it was free to use. And it's important to mention this beforehand because it turns out a lot of the stuff they worked on would later find its way into other future web browsers. By 1994, Mark Andreessen would partner with Jeb Clark, and who was the founder of Silicon Graphics. They created Mosaic Communications. It was later renamed to Netscape Communications, and they started to develop a web browser for the consumer market. So that's going to sound really familiar to anyone who was, using computers around the time of the first browser wars. Netscape should definitely ring a bell.
And this is around the time that Windows 95 is basically about to go gold and go on sale. So we're still on, in Windows 3.1 era at the moment, I think.
Yep, yep. And I mean, the Netscape Navigator, I think, was the very... I might have used Mosaic when I was in college, come to think of it. But I'm pretty sure I quickly transitioned to Netscape Navigator. And that became my browser of choice in those days. You know, I didn't ask you, Nate, what browser do you typically use when you are...
Safari for almost everything.
So you are clearly a Mac owner.
I am a Mac owner. I love Safari because I use almost no add-ons at all because I just want speed and fast and I need it to sync everything. And Safari's always worked really well for me.
That makes sense. I detest Safari with a passion that burns brighter than 1,000 exploding suns, but it's mostly because I don't use a Mac. If I did use a Mac, then like if you're in the Apple infrastructure, it's amazing. If you're all in, it's phenomenal. If you're only kind of sort of in, it gets really irritating really quickly. But then I'm all in on the Google infrastructure, so I use Chrome.
Yes, that's the difference, you see, because the browser is the thing you use the most, I would imagine. And so if your phone is the thing that you carry and use the most in the day, then it stands to reason that you're going to want to use a browser that works best on a phone.
Right. And that's kind of peeking ahead to some of the issues with Internet Explorer. So 1994, we get the NCSA licensing the commercial rights to Mosaic to a company that was called at the time Spyglass. The company no longer exists, so that should tell you how things turn out in the future. Spyglass ended up licensing that same technology to other companies, including Microsoft. So the Mosaic code ends up making its way to Microsoft, and that was really important to Microsoft because, as Nate was saying, they were preparing Windows 95 for launch, and they really wanted to have a component in there that would be a web browser. And they had decided that it made more sense to license that technology from someone else rather than trying to develop it in-house. So that's what led them to Spyglass and licensing the Mosaic code.
We'll be back with more of this classic episode of Tech Stuff after this quick break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty, beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
October 1994, Netscape would release a beta version of their project, which was codenamed Mozilla. That'll become important later, too. It was designated 0.96B. I decided early on that when we start looking at the actual builds of Internet Explorer, we're going to look at whole numbers only, because otherwise the path leads to madness.
You mean you're not going to consider Chrome version 26.9.6432.364?
No.
I mean, that was a seminal release.
I mean, it was beautiful, really. I mean, the fact that it improved so much upon the predecessor that came out earlier that same day is phenomenal. But no, I'm going to skip it. Yeah, so we move on to August 23rd, 1995. That is the day Microsoft released the Windows 95 operating system. Man, I still remember the commercials for Windows 95. They had this little band, the Rolling Stones, that had a song called Start Me Up that was played during the Windows 95 commercials, because that was also the introduction of the start button on Windows. The little button that wouldn't quit, or people wouldn't let the little button quit. Nope. And they introduced a web browser, which they named Internet Explorer. Made a lot of sense. It was in fact a way to navigate through the internet, specifically the World Wide Web.
But this is the point. Can I just interject here? Because this is the thing that I've always hated about Internet Explorer, is that it's a web browser.
Right.
Why is it not called Web Explorer?
I think they were afraid they might have some sort of confusion with spiders or something. I don't know, Nate. It confuses me too. But yeah, Internet Explorer 1.0 came out with Windows 95. They had an agreement with Spyglass, which was incredibly clever. Some might call it sneaky and underhanded. Their agreement with Spyglass. So Spyglass makes the code, the technology that Internet Explorer runs on. Internet Explorer, the agreement with Spyglass was that Microsoft would pay a quarterly fee to Spyglass. All right, that's cool. And they also agreed to share royalties for Internet Explorer. But Microsoft also decided to bundle Internet Explorer with Windows 95, so Internet Explorer itself wasn't on sale. And so if you're not selling it, you can't make royalties, which means they didn't have to share any money from the Windows 95 sales to Spyglass, which I thought was
sneaky.
Yeah, pretty sneaky. That would end up biting them a little bit later. But at any rate, at the time, they were just like, hey, we really scored on this. Now, when they started, only 6 Microsoft employees, according to every source I saw, only 6 people in Microsoft were actually working on Internet Explorer, which is kind of hard to believe today. At the time, the web was not what you and I are used to. It had about 20 basic tags in HTML that allowed you to construct pages and change the style, things like tables and the font size, that kind of stuff. So it's really, really basic. And if you ever look at screenshots of old browsers and old web pages, I mean, it mostly looks like the blandest Wikipedia page you have ever seen, with no pictures or anything like that. A lot of the early ones don't have any pictures on them. Because if you did put a picture on it, then you were shooting yourself in the foot. Most of us did not have any fast connection to any kind of network. So accessing a website with pictures meant that you would start, you'd navigate to the page, walk away from your computer for 10 minutes, and then come back to see if the pictures had all loaded.
I remember it well. I particularly remember it when I was trying to view pictures on the now defunct page Cat Scan, where people would use flatbed scanners to scan the undersides of their cats.
Right.
And I could actually walk away and be very British and make a cup of tea while waiting for the photo of the cat to arrive on my computer.
I guess this is the point where I mentioned that Nate has two particular great passions in life, which include metal and cats.
Yes. And the other ones, but they are the ones I am known for, it seems.
Those are the two whenever I hear anything from you on social media, there's a probably a 40% chance it's going to fall into one of those two categories.
Yeah.
So there's still quite a few other things, but they don't hit as high a slice on the pie chart.
Yes, that's very true. Very true.
So one of the things about the limitations of HTML that was a particular thorn in the sides of early web browsers and web users was that the limitations meant people had to find creative ways around those limitations to create rich user experiences. Did they ever use that term in the UK, the rich user experience or rich internet experience?
Yes. I mean, we probably heard it quite a bit. I don't remember it particularly, but I imagine it was there amongst all the other ones like zip drives and, you know.
Right. All right. The rich user experience, that was something where the idea was that you wanted to create an experience for the user that went beyond just simple text lines and pictures. So one of the earliest ones would be MIDIs that would loop and there'd be no way to stop them.
I do remember those. Yes, yeah. I do remember those. Yes, MIDIs. My goodness, MIDIs. Yes.
Yeah, so just the days of MySpace where you would go to someone's MySpace page. I mean, this that goes beyond what we're talking about here, but even then, I'm not sad to see those days go. However, what it meant was that people had to create software that would be a plugin, an enhancement to a web browser to allow users to access certain types of content, largely streaming content, whether it was audio or video. So if you had a web browser in those days, you had to often enhance it with these plugins, which made the browsers clunkier, slower. They required more memory. In those days, also, memory was not as plentiful as it is today, computer memory. So your whole computer would start to run more slowly if you tried to access anything that had any kind of, you know, video or flash animation. Flash is another example, some plugins that you had to have in order to get more out of the web pages. We would not see advances to HTML for a while that would address this. I mean, the whole point of HTML5 is to take away the need for all these different plugins that often can become security vulnerabilities. The idea being that this way we can support those different functions natively within HTML and not have to have a Swiss Army knife style web browser where you've added all these extra features. The first version of Internet Explorer was about as bare bones as you can get. And the second one came out November 22nd, 1995. So if you remember, I said the first one came out August 23rd, 1995. IE2 comes out November 22nd, 1995. That's an incredibly narrow window for an entire version upgrade. You know, it's fast does not really go into it. This one was for Windows 95 and Windows NT 3.5 and Windows NT 4.0. So that means within 3 months, you get a full version upgrade. But that was actually kind of typical in the early days because the browsers were getting more and more advanced very quickly. Everyone was really interested in this. This was the days when the media was starting to take notice of the World Wide Web, and it was going beyond just the governments and colleges and research facilities. So with that focus, you wanted to really get your browser to be, a destination people wanted to go to. The people needed this technology.
There was another feature that they thought people needed in Internet Explorer 2, I remember.
What's that?
Yum, yum, yum. Delicious cookies.
Oh, you know what? Those are important. They have been misused. And that is unfortunate. They can cause huge problems. They are definitely one of those things you've got to worry about if you are concerned about internet privacy. However, that being said, it's also nice to be able to navigate to a website. You're in the middle of doing something. You have to shut down and leave. When you navigate to that same website on that same machine, you can pick up right where you left off. That's thanks to cookies. So cookies are just really short bits of data, really just short range of bits, if you want to get down to it. And they act as kind of a identifier and a placeholder, so that when you start a session with a web page, the website, the web server can keep track of who you are and what you are doing, so that if you do leave for some reason and come back, you can pick up where you left off. So in retail, for example, if I put something in my shopping cart, but I haven't completed the transaction and I leave the website, the next time I go back to that website, I might still have that item in the shopping cart because the cookies tell the server, hey, it's that same dude who just can't commit to purchasing this squeaky toy for his dog, which would be a great example for me. So cookies definitely had their place, but obviously have been, they've got a lot of, there's a lot of bad rap about cookies too, because of things like the idea of tracking web browsing activity and sharing things that you might have thought were private otherwise. But they come from a good place.
They do. And they are useful. Let's be honest. They are very useful. Yeah. The web would not be what the web is now, in a bad way, I think, were it not for cookies.
Well, because
they just allowed the internet to be more personal.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, the idea that your experience on the web is at least in some part defined by and tuned to you, so that you have the experience you want, or at least if you're working at it, you can have the experience you want. I wish that it were effortless, so that just through the use of the web, it becomes the way you want. For some people, it becomes the way it is rather than the way they want it to be, because they don't know the tricks to, you know, kind of tune it as much as they would like. But without cookies, it would not be possible at all. You would just have the same experience every single time you logged into any web page. It would be as if you are there day zero. Like that's the first time you had ever visited it, and you would have to go through whatever it is, you know, like whether it's logging into a service or adding things into a list, whatever that might be. You would have to do that every single time if it weren't for things like cookies.
Yeah.
The next version of Internet Explorer, number 3, if you're keeping count, wouldn't come along until August 13, 1996. So they went almost a full year. Unthinkable. Without coming out with a new version. This was the first one to really start to get some traction in the web browser wars, because the other browsers had, first of all, you got to keep in mind, it was still a pretty small piece of the overall population pie. There weren't that many people online on the web in 1996. There were lots, but if you compare it to the number of people who weren't, it was a tiny number. That being said, there were things like Netscape and Mosaic and other browsers that were already, they already had a good share of the market. So IE was just starting to pick up. By the end of 97, it accounted for about a third of the browser market, just under, around 30%. And that gets us into the browser wars, which are like Star Wars, but more boring. But in my notes, I wrote, many Bothans died to bring us this information.
Oh, I'm so out of my depth to even understand why that is funny.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Sure it is. Okay, well, you're speaking to the guy who hasn't even seen all the Star Wars films.
It hurts me to hear that. But
I know.
Then again, my original co-host, Chris Paulette, I don't think even to this day has seen the movie Jaws. So he killed a small piece of me that day when he revealed that information. But that, of course, is a quote.
We've got more to say in this classic episode of Tech Stuff after these quick messages.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. on the network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Take your work on the road, and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200K for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billings, scheduling, and more. With a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but, like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
Internet Explorer 3 was also the first browser that did not use the Spyglass source code. There were elements of Spyglass technology in there, so that was still listed in the About page on Internet Explorer. They kind of had a license little bit about how some of the technology was licensed from them. But they had moved away from Spyglass to start working on a different source code to underlie Internet Explorer. And it was the first one to introduce Internet Mail to Internet Explorer and News 1.0 and the Windows Address Book. Neither of those things would matter for very long, but they were included in Internet Explorer 3. And they added in the support for lots of the plugins that Netscape could use. And that goes back to what I was talking about earlier. It increased the ability for Internet Explorer to access certain features that otherwise would just be unplayable. You get a little red X saying, this doesn't work here.
I remember it well.
Yeah. This also, by the way, one of the reasons why I love the development of HTML5 and the conversion to HTML5 is that I also remember the days of those plugins leading to lots of opportunities for hackers to create fake alert messages saying, hey, I know you want to see this, but you can't unless you first download the plugin or update your plugin so that you can watch it. But in fact, instead of it actually being a plugin, it was a virus that you were agreeing to download and install to your machine. So you get one of those messages saying, oh, you want to watch this, but you need to update to the latest version of Real Player, for example. And it wasn't actually a real player update or install file. It was an install file for some malware. That was rampant at a certain point in the history of the internet. So the slow migration away from the plugin days is something that I've been waiting for a long time. Because I get tired of answering those questions. IE3 also added support for cascading style sheets. Now, this, again, very technical part of it, but it's basically an easy way to define the style, the appearance of a web page. One of the things that was a big challenge in the early days of web browsers was making sure that the web page was going to show up the way the web designer intended it. Nate, did you ever have to build a website without the use of a WYSIWYG editor or something where you had to do it in like a text editor?
I taught myself to do it. I do that in text. And my girlfriend Kate actually still does.
Wow.
And she can type responsive web stuff out in by hand. It's quite impressive.
That is impressive. The first web pages I ever built, which I am not going to share, so don't even bother looking for them, because they are awful. If they do still exist somewhere out there, I am embarrassed by their presence. But at any rate, I also did that the old school way, where you had a text editor, you typed in all the markup language and the actual content of the web page. Then you would have to save it, then open up a browser, navigate to the proper address of that page, which probably wasn't even published online yet. It was just native on your computer. Look to see if it was actually showing up properly in the web browser you were using. And then if anything wasn't, you had to quit out, go back into your text editor, change things there, and do it all over again. The bad thing in the early days is that even if you got it to work properly on whichever web browser you were using, there was no guarantee that someone else's web browser, a different web browser, was going to show it in that same way. So you might take hours to painstakingly create and craft a web page. And if anyone was using a different web browser, they might get a totally different experience anyway. So that was one of the...
You kids don't know how easy you've got it with your dynamic websites and your responsive designs. You know, back in those days, we were working out how to write out tables in text editors. Or there was this one piece of software that I remember getting for free at some point, and it used DHTML, and it was actually, it was WYSIWYG, but it was like drag and drop. And all the positions were sort of relative, so you could have objects anywhere, and it was brilliant.
Right. Yeah, WYSIWYG, for those of you who don't know what that acronym stands for, it's what you see is what you get. The idea being that you have an editor that lets you edit within, like you are actually seeing what the web page looks like as you're building it. So you don't have to do this swap between code and the appearance of the page. It's all there. Like, you might be able, most of them have an HTML editor component, so you can switch it to HTML and just see the markup language and type in that way if you want to. But a lot of them have it where there are different templates that are built out. Their entire business is based on that. And some of them do it incredibly well. I use them, in fact, when I'm building web pages these days, because while I remember doing HTML coding, that was also when there were very few tags. So I don't think I could do it today, because it would look like a website from 1995 if I were to build one today that way. And while that would be comedic, it would not be very useful. Internet Explorer 3 was also when we got a very important development with IE. That is the logo of the lowercase e, so that you get that icon of the lowercase e that represents Internet Explorer. Don't know what our world would be like if they had gone with something else.
A W for web, maybe. Throwing that out there again.
It's madness, Nate. It's madness.
Yes.
That would have led to great strife in the world. And 9 days after IE3 came out, security experts discovered a backdoor vulnerability that they called the Princeton Word Macro Virus Loophole. So it had a very catchy name. Backdoor vulnerabilities are seriously bad news, no matter what software you're talking about. That's the sort of vulnerability that gives an attacker access to your machine at whatever level you are logged in at. So if, for example, you had your Windows machine, you are logged in as an admin on that machine. Let's say that's the level of access you have. And if this is your personal computer, then yes, that's the access you have. This backdoor would give people that access, which is bad news. I mean, they could make your computer do whatever they wanted to at that point, install software that you didn't intend to have installed or direct your computer to attack other computers.
Mostly, I would just mostly open people's CD drawers, print things out, leave messages on their screen, fire up the Simpsons DOS game, that kind of stuff.
I do know. I have seen that happen. I remember seeing someone who had allowed that, and their CD drawer, the little drive door, would open and close over and over. And they're like, "I don't know what's happening." I said, "What's happened is you've downloaded something you shouldn't have, that has handed over control to your computer. So we're going to start in safe mode and we'll begin from there and see if we can fix this."
Yeah. And uninstall Bonsai Buddy while we're at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. Well, in fall of 1996, Internet Explorer would account for about a third of the browser market, like I was talking about. That's where they really started to get traction. And in 1997, the NCSA stops supporting the development of Mosaic. So the web browser that really started all this off in a real way had finally kind of run out of steam on the development side. But the browsers that still use that basic technology and had continued to develop it, they kept going. Like Netscape Navigator continued on, although, of course, they had forked off of the Mosaic source code. So it was not the exact same stuff that was Mosaic. It had changed and evolved on its own. It's kind of like if you look at an evolutionary tree and you see where two different species have forked, same sort of thing here, except we're talking about computer programs, obviously. And 97 was also when Spyglass threatened Microsoft with a contractual audit because of that quarterly fee royalty arrangement we talked about earlier. The fact that they were getting this quarterly fee but not really any royalties had kind of upset Spyglass, because they said, well, when we agreed to this, the implication was that Internet Explorer, or whatever the web browser was going to be called at that time, was going to be a separate product. It was going to be something sold by Microsoft instead of bundled with Windows. And ended up prompting Microsoft to settle with Spyglass. I think the sum I see most frequently is $8 million, which is not a small amount of money, but when you compare it to some of the huge deals going on seemingly casually in the world of tech, and especially the world of the internet, it's a pittance.
Yeah.
A tiny amount.
And for Microsoft as well.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Especially for Microsoft. Yeah. $8 million. It's probably what they have in between the cushions of their executive lounge couch. You just sort through there and find a spare $8 or $9 million, I'm sure. Which I think if you convert into English currency is approximately 15 pounds. I'm not entirely sure. I'm not good with that sort of thing, but I know it's somewhere.
Hey, look, the exchange rate's all messed up at the moment.
All I know is that whenever I visit London, I'm always looking for deals, because I realize, like, I don't know. I honestly don't know how much money I'm spending right now. Internet Explorer 4 comes out in 1997. That is marketed with the slogan, "The web the way you want it," which I guess is true if you don't want it to be particularly good. It also handled rich text files and plain text email in their Internet Mail and News program, which was now Outlook Express 4. It's called Outlook Express 4, but it really was the first Outlook Express. This is where we run into Microsoft's habit of numbering things in a way that probably makes sense to someone in Microsoft and no sense to anyone else. Like, yeah. I don't know, why is Windows 10 Windows 10 when it could have been Windows 9? Apart from the fact that calling it Windows 9 could have caused some confusion with people who are running legacy systems that still rely on Windows 95. I can't answer.
In an era, Jonathan, my friend, where we have the iPhone 5S and the Galaxy S5, I think we are in an era where we need to have Windows 10 and OS 10.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I'm fine with that, I guess. I Honestly, at this point, we could just say, all right, letters and numbers make no difference in the world of the internet. So just go with it. So we don't have HTML email support in Outlook Express 4. It could just do rich text files and plain text emails. So you didn't get any of the incredibly fun stuff like people sending you pictures in the middle of their emails. And what, if you're detecting some lackluster enthusiasm in my voice, it's because those jokes only go so far with me. So please don't send me emails with lots of pictures in them. But first of all, my Outlook immediately blocks them unless I tell it to allow the photos. But you're just wasting bandwidth, really. I'm not a huge fan of those. But obviously, it makes it look better than it would if it were just a rich text file. And they integrated RealPlayer as a streaming media player within Internet Explorer 4. Do you remember those days, Nate, where...
Yes, I do. Yeah. I do. The beautiful days of RealPlayer playing inside Internet Explorer.
Oh.
Yes, those wonderful days. I love those days. I'll tell you an interesting RealPlayer fact here.
Okay.
RealPlayer used to be brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What Real did was fantastic. It actually made video stream properly. Back in the day, while the player itself might have been a clunky mess, the compression they used was genuinely some of the most innovative online technology, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The problem is that everything else about it was awful.
Mm-hmm.
And bundled as a plugin also made it a clunky experience. So mm-hmm. it just always felt like a poor piece of technology, but actually what it did was fantastic.
Yeah, there was a time where, I mean, I just remember this held true for way too long, where there were competing plugins. And in order for you to be able to watch video online, it meant that you had to have three or four plugins on your browser, because one site would use one format, another site would use, you know, some would be Flash-based, some would be real player base. You would have all these different competing formats, and you didn't have a lot of options of like a one player fits all kind of solution. So it ended up meaning that you had to add all these different plugins if you wanted to be able to experience all this different media across different sites. I don't miss those days at all. I mean, Microsoft really held on to it for a long time. Silverlight was one of those things that when I would encounter it online and I would see something like, oh, you need to download Silverlight to see this. I thought, really? Are we really still there?
Yeah.
Can we get beyond that and just have everyone say, okay, I wanted to be the person to, or the entity to define what the standard was, but at some point I have to admit my approach is not what has been considered standard, and I'm going to get on board with what everyone else is doing. It wasn't like that for a very long time. In fact, you could argue it's still not like that with certain types of media, but it just made it no fun, really. Like, you would go to a site and say, oh, I have to add another plugin, which again added that vulnerability. If you had to add in plugin after plugin, eventually you got, you got conditioned to the point where you thought, oh, of course I'm going to need another plugin to see whatever this thing is. Never mind the fact that it's a plugin that I don't recognize and that I've never, heard of before. I'll go ahead and install it, and then you make your system vulnerable.
It's just one of those things that was a necessity at the time. And I think really what plugins did is they just fueled innovation. Like a lot of what was a plugin back in the day is now either baked into the browser or is baked into HTML itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you think about HTML5 supporting new video formats, like WebM that Google is behind, that's something that back in the day you would need a plugin for.
Sure.
You don't need those anymore. And it was probably a necessary life cycle.
That's true. I mean, without it, then web pages would be very bland and limited and would not be nearly as important or influential as the web has become over the years. I mean, this is also, we're looking at the late 90s when we're starting to get to a fever pitch of what the web could be, which of course culminated in and then collapsed with the .com bubble bursting. that whole era, everyone was starting to see what the web could potentially be. But if we relied simply upon what HTML could deliver back in those days, the web would have been a lot more, you know, utilitarian and less interesting. So I definitely agree that the plugins were a necessary part. It was also just, as living through it, it just was also frustrating. IE4 also supported dynamic HTML for the first time, which allowed for more interactive web pages. Again, that rich user experience we were talking about earlier. That was an important element. And by bundling Internet Explorer with Windows, Microsoft ends up leveraging itself into a 60% market share of all web browsers. This was a huge story. It really turned things around, going from an underdog to the major player out of all browsers. So not just, you know, Mozilla's or Netscape, rather, Netscape's Navigator. Now, if you add in all the different competitors, they paled, but it was partly because the market share for PCs far outweighed other computer platforms, especially for businesses and casual users. I mean, you obviously still had a lot of Unix machines running server software and in various research and R&D areas, things like that. But if you're talking about the average person, they owned a PC. The Mac was not a competitor really at this time. And that meant that if you were going to buy a PC and you had a web browser just bundled in with it, it made sense to go ahead and use it. In fact, for people who were not really savvy with the web, that was their, it was either AOL was the web here in the US or it was Internet Explorer.
Yeah. And it was here too. The AOL, some of my first web, experiences were AOL, the walled garden.
Yep.
Happy times. Simple times.
Yeah, isn't it great when you
save
have an entity that decides what is and isn't the web for you? That makes life so much easier.
Stay tuned for the exciting conclusion of this Tech Stuff Classic episode right after we take this break.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more, with a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Pacaso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
So May 18th, 1998, this is where we get into where Microsoft runs into some trouble because of this policy of lumping Internet Explorer in with its operating system. The United States government brought a lawsuit against Microsoft Corporation. In fact, the Department of Justice was looking at an antitrust suit saying that the company had practiced predatory strategies to push other companies out of the web browser market and the operating system market, as it turns out. Saying that because they had packaged Internet Explorer with the operating system, and because the operating system was really the only game in town for the most part for operating systems, it had the majority market share. If you were buying a PC, more often than not, it was going to have Windows preloaded on it. They were essentially saying you have stacked the deck against any competing company and you're pushing them out, and that's not fair. That's why we're bringing this antitrust suit against you. This was big news, and it wasn't the only place where Microsoft was having issues. It was also having problems in Europe. There were European antitrust suits brought against Microsoft. They were actually looking at more interesting things in a way. They were looking at how there were also allegations that the operating system had been designed so that it worked really well with Internet Explorer and didn't work so well with any other browser. Almost as if Microsoft had taken pains to create an operating system that would on purpose decrease the use and utility of competing web browsers. And that was a huge red flag. So you had these massive antitrust lawsuits going up against Microsoft that wouldn't be resolved for years. I mean, we all know these lawsuits can last ages. And in fact, it wouldn't pan out in the U.S. until 2001, and there would be this enormous settlement. And originally, the ruling told Microsoft, the Department of Justice said, hey, you're going to have to split your company into two companies. You're going to have one that is building the operating system business and one that's building the software that exists on top of the operating system. But they're going to have to operate as two separate entities. Because if you package them all together, you have an unfair advantage over anyone who wants to build software for that operating system. Ultimately, that did not happen. I mean, if you are aware, Microsoft is a single company. It hasn't been split. But that was originally what the ruling was. And it was a huge news item in the day. Because anyone who wanted to use any other web browser was already mad at Microsoft for appearing to make it more difficult to use those web browsers. So I remember those days well, too, because already at that point, I was not a huge... And like I said, I had been using Netscape Navigator as my early web browser for years and years, partly because when I first started using the web, I was a college student. So I got Netscape Navigator for free because it was a college application. I didn't have to purchase it. In fact, I was pretty stingy about purchasing one for a long time. I was like, why should I pay for this thing that I've had for free for so long? And I didn't like the way Internet Explorer rendered web pages or the user interface or anything. So I was very upset at this time when I heard about this.
But I mean, Internet Explorer at this point was actually available on the Mac, wasn't it? This was one of the last ones, actually, that was available on the Mac. IE5, I think, was the very last one they made.
Yeah. So you could actually use Internet Explorer on the Macintosh at this time. Yeah. To be fair, though, the Mac was not what it is today in those days.
No.
These are also the days where Steve Jobs had been forced out of Apple for a while and was just starting to come back to redefine what the Mac was.
Yeah, so, this is almost exactly the time he came back. And this was just before the iMac was released.
Yeah.
If not almost, depending on the particular part of the history we're on, almost month-wise at the moment, this is when that happened.
Yeah. So we've got this lawsuit going on. In 1998, it starts. In 1999, IE was the dominant web browser, which was not helping Microsoft's case in that lawsuit. It was essentially being pointed at as C. If people are complaining about how this browser matches up against other browsers, how can you argue that the customer satisfaction or the desire for this particular web browser is what's driving the dominance in the market? It's clearly because it's tied so intricately with the operating system. That would be the kind of argument that the Department of Justice would level against Microsoft.
Yeah, but this was IE at this point was just so key to Microsoft.
Yeah. You know,
it had like 1,000 people working on it at this point, just on the browser.
From the six people of IE1 to the 1,000 and $100 million being invested every quarter into, or actually every year at this point, into Internet Explorer. This is then the IE5 days, because that came out in March 1999. They had a couple of preview versions come out in 98, but 99 was when they officially launched it. This was the one that would come with Windows 98 second edition, as well as Windows 2000.
And the dot-com boom. I mean, this is 1,000 people working on Internet Explorer, $100 million a year. These are the months just before the dot-com bubble burst.
Right. And it's also, this is one where if you were a user, you probably wouldn't have noticed a huge difference in the interface between 4 and 5, but a lot of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes, right, the back end of the browser had been upgraded, which prompted Paul Thurrott to write that IE 5.0 is IE 4.0 done right. So in other words, the things that were innovative in Internet Explorer 4 but were still kind of clunky were now much more smooth in the new version. So IE 5 was seen as a big step up. And that was really important because we had this huge boom of innovation in the dot-com world, which, as we all know, was not sustainable long-term anyway. But there was no greater moment of focus in the media upon the internet than at this time. I would argue even today, as instrumental and important as the internet is, and as we have all these different ways of accessing it, including applications that can work with the web or separately from the web, things like Twitter and Facebook. I would say that in this time, the late 90s, going right into 2000, that was when we were at the peak of focus on the internet, specifically on the World Wide Web. It's funny because if you look at the news reports from a couple of years before this, that was when you had like the stuff that was caught on camera, but not originally broadcast, where you had news anchors kind of talking about, what is this web thing? What is that? What's that A symbol for? What is email? Like, it
went
from
that .com button.
Yeah, exactly. It went from that to everyone now has to have a website. If you're a business, you had to have a website. Didn't matter if you had anything important to put on there, but you had to have a website. That was the day, and IE5 was the perfect browser at the perfect time to really, you know, tap into that, which is good because IE6 would be an almost 180 degree turn from that. So before that, just one little sad bit of news. On March 26th, 2000, Spyglass was bought out by OpenTV, and Spyglass became no more. Now, that was, of course, the company that had licensed the Mosaic technology from the NCSA and then further licensed it to Microsoft. It no longer existed as an entity of its own at that point.
That was the story of Internet Explorer Part 1. We will continue the story next week in the next classic episode. If you have suggestions for topics I should cover in future episodes of Tech Stuff, please reach out on Twitter. The handle for the show is TechStuffHSW, and I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.